Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
This is the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. Our program tonight is the importance of diversity in the environmental movement for the 21st century. With Adriana Quintero, who's from the National Resources Defense Council and founder and director of Voices Verdes. And Adriana is going to introduce you now to our distinguished panel. Adriana?
Thank you so much, Anne, and thank you to the Commonwealth Club for hosting this important conversation. I have the honor to be here today with truly some amazing women, and I would not even begin to do it justice to read you their lengthy bios. So what I wanted to do in light of the theme today, which is about diversity and what that means, is to invite each of our panelists to say a little something about what brings them to the issue, because one of the things that we get caught up in life, and especially in our workplaces, are titles and where we went to school and, you know, where we worked before, what we published, what awards we got. And what strikes me about that model is that that is where diversity starts to break down. For me. So this is my intro, and then I'll let everybody say their part. But that's where we start to build up walls, because it becomes divisive. It becomes competitive. It becomes about where you went to school. Did you get a BA, a BS, an MA, a PhD, a JD? And it's a soup of letters they're hard earned. I mean, credit to everybody who's earned big degrees. However, they don't define us. What defines us are our histories, where we were born, how we grew up, what our families looked like, what our communities looked like. As Anne just said, you know, living in the Presidio and playing golf there, that's why that's special to her. That personalizes it. That's her story about that. What brings us all to this table today is not the fact that we learned something in school. It's what we lived. And until we're able to really absorb this experience and bring that to the table and use that as our calling cards, we're not going to solve these problems with diversity. Because yes, I might work in an environmental organization, and that's what I do 9 to 9, if not more than that. But I'm much more than that. I'm also a feminist, and I'm also about human rights and about workers' rights and about indigenous rights and all of these many things, and about children and about food sometimes. So we don't want to pigeon people into a specific space simply because of what's on their resume. That being said, I hope that we can have, I'm going to pass it on to our panelists, who are truly incredible people and who have dedicated an immense time, a part of their life, to making sure that we crack this nut, that we solve the issue with of diversity, not only by diversifying on race and socioeconomic background, but also on the stories that we bring to the table and who we are and why we do what we do. And I think that that is how we start to win some of these environmental issues, taking it out of the science, taking it out of this hole and cubbyhole of environmentalism, and really talking about how these issues permeate our lives for each and every one of us. So with that, I will just go straight down the aisle to Whitney Tome. And Whitney is the director of Green 2.0 at the Raven Group and counsel at the Raven Group. But again, she's so much more than that. And I want to welcome Whitney. Thank you for joining us all the way from Washington, D.C. Tell us a little bit about what brings this issue. Why is this issue so important to you?
Great question, and thank you again so much for the invite. I'm delighted to be here. So for me, it was in part accidental that I even got into this work, but I realized in driving to college that I closed the door in my car. I drove 5.5 hours, opened the door, and smelled the air in Vermont and said to myself, this feels different. Something about the air so fresh it should slap you, was sort of just sort of perplexing to me. And like, why is this different? Why does this feel different from home? And why doesn't all air feel like this? And so for me, that was sort of the introduction to environmentalism, of just the simple notice of the world felt different in different places. And what about air, water, land, food was different in different places, and why that was, and then how I could help. And that started me on a journey, but I'd say the corner turning around diversity especially was realizing that when I stood in rooms working on oceans issues and fisheries specifically, that I was always, always the only woman of color in the room. I worked with fishermen. You can imagine what that demographic looks like. And recognizing, like, why is that? Why am I the only one? Why aren't there more people like me in this work who care about it, who focus on oceans and fish issues? And why don't I actually take a step to change that rather than just thinking about it? So that's how I got into this work. But honored to continue to do it and build it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Can I ask you one question about your story? Where was home that it was so different from Vermont?
It wasn't. It wasn't. So I grew up in New Jersey. Okay. The Garden State. Yes, it actually is the Garden State. But there is something about Vermont that also lacked a lot of visual things, too. Like, Vermont doesn't have billboards. And if you've never been there, it's a really sort of remarkable thing. And you realize, like, how different it is in a state. And it was just something about also the fact that they had more cows than people until, like, 1980. That just sort of strikes you about a place that it is so not densely packed. That really sort of struck me as, like, huh. What about this is different?
That's right. Well, that's a great story. Thank you so much for sharing that. Pallavi, tell us a little bit about your story.
Great. And thank you, Adriana, for setting it up in such a fluid way to bring our stories into it, because at the end of the day, where our passions lie are really informed by our experiences in life. And for me, it started in the Catholic school I attended in the foothills of the Himalayas in India. And I don't credit my nuns for a lot of things, but I do credit them for the exposure to social services that they required us to participate in. And it became very evident to me very early on that through the social work that we were doing through school, there was a system that was actively set up where certain people have access to things that others assume are basic rights. And that happened in terms of education, in terms of clean water, in terms of transportation, in terms of housing. So the issues weren't limited to environment in the strict definition of environment. But environment is not just air, water, and soil. It is our urban environments too. So it started there. It took me a really long, windy road to end up in the field of environment. But once I was there, I was blown away, especially in the U.S., the system of inequity and injustice that, and what fueled the environmental movement here and how it actively kept out certain sectors and certain class, certain ethnicities and certain races. So for me, diversity has to be hand in hand, but thought of it differently from equity and inclusion and justice. And I know at some point you and I were talking about our vision, and I think my vision is at some point we won't need a panel like this. We won't have to talk about why it's important because it'll become so integral to our work. So I hope to continue to chip in and try to get us there.
Well, wonderful. Thank you so much for your work. And it's great to hear that that was something that the nuns brought to the table, because one of the things that we've found, and I know that a lot of my fellow panelists have found this, is that we, for a long time, the environmental movement failed to tap into the religious community and those deeply held values that are truly moral and religious beliefs that opened an entire realm for us and new partnerships, which were so critical to build. So that's, I'm going to put a pin in that one. We'll talk a little bit more about that. And thank you. Now, Michelle, tell us a little bit about your story. Michelle doesn't have her placard up, but she's from Green for All. So welcome, Michelle.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks for having me. Green for All is a national organization working to build a green economy strong enough to lift people out of poverty. I feel like I need to say that again. Green for All is an organization trying to create a strong green economy that's strong enough to lift people out of poverty. So I want to start with that, because we're not just working on environmental issues. We're seeing environmental issues as intricately tied to economic justice, to racial justice, and so many other things. So I was talking with Adriana before this panel and telling her, you know, I've worked with Green for All for a little over a year. And before then, had never touched environmental issues, wasn't passionate about it. And I will actually admit that it probably took a few months into my job before I found that passion. And that's because I think a lot of times electric vehicles and solar and all of these sort of future forward thinking concepts about a green economy are only available for wealthy white communities. And don't feel, you know, accessible. It's not the kind of thing that you see in your neighborhood. And so there's a gap there, right? And then a lot of times there are the environmental solutions or the fights, the campaigns that are asking folks to participate are to save polar bears or melting ice caps, right? And when you're coming from a community that is working class, you know, families just trying to put food on the table or dealing with so many other issues like immigrant rights and social justice across the board, access to higher education, like all of these issues, saving the polar bears feels very far away from my day-to-day experience, right? So I will say it was a journey to come to the issue. But after I started at Green for All, about a month into my time, we went on the ground in Flint, Michigan, the city that's been just completely poisoned, an entire American city poisoned with polluted water that lead poisoned families and children, led to women losing babies, kids getting sick, right? Lead poisoning causes behavioral issues in children and developmental issues. One woman shared a story with us about the inability to just safely bathe her kid. So forget about drinking clean water. But one time she was trying to bathe her 3-year-old son who had had an accident, because that's potty training age, and put him in the water for a few minutes before he started screaming, "Mommy, mommy, it's burning." Mm-hmm. And she was confused by that because, well, she knew you couldn't drink the water. You should be able to rinse with it, right? No. So she pulls him out of the water and she sees that his skin is cracking and bleeding from taking a bath. Another woman talked about her ear bleeding after taking a shower. I mean, these are the kinds of things that are happening in places like Flint and in places closer to us, even here in the Bay Area. And that reminded me of a time several years back before I ever came to Green Issues, where I was watching on the news from my home in Newark, over on the Newark Fremont, on the other side of the Dumbarton Bridge. I was watching on the news about the time when the Chevron oil, or the most recent time, the Chevron oil refinery had an explosion, and they were calling for residents to shelter in place. And they were literally telling people, I mean, this is the first time I had really seen this, where they were literally telling people to get inside their homes and close their doors and windows, and to, if you could, find towels or blankets or anything that you could do to shove into the cracks, right, of your doors, because the air right outside your door it's filling your lungs with poison, right? You will have breathing problems. Like, you might have breathing problems and have a, you know, like, it could be fatal, right? So I had a friend, Blanca, who grew up and was living in Richmond at this time. And I immediately called her, like any of you would, right? If a friend or family member were living in a community where you were watching this on the news. And I said, Blanca, are you okay? And she said, yeah, I know what you're talking about. I'm inside. It's fine. When things like this happen, the city sounds the alarm. We know to come inside. It's all good, right? It's happened before. We know what drill is. And connecting those two issues for me, what I had heard from my friend several years back and what I was witnessing on the ground in Flint just really hit home. They're poisoning our air and our water, and they think it's okay. And this abusive relationship that the fossil fuel industry has with low-income communities and communities of color in particular needs to end. And so that's why I get up in the morning. That's why I do, you know, have the passion for these issues and fight, because our lives are literally at stake.
Wow, those are really powerful stories. And I think that the theme here to me is really clear. It's not that environmental issues don't have passion to them. Mm-hmm. They do. It's just the way we've been talking about them. We haven't been talking. The environmental movement hasn't been a stories-based movement. It's been an issues-based movement. It's been too heavily steeped in the science and not enough in the people. And if we as humans hear a story that doesn't have people in it, it's hard for us to really make that connection. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I don't feel a rush of passion when I talk about, parts per million. I feel the passion when I look at the people living on the Marshall Islands who are going to lose their entire island and have nowhere to go. I feel passion when I hear the stories of Flint or of Richmond or children who are suffering from asthma. That's where the passion lies. So we've talked a little bit already about how we can build that passion. But I think that there's one question that I find difficult to answer, and that's why does this tension persist? Why is it still hard for us to go all in on the human side of environment? And I'm not going to pretend to have the answer. I have some ideas, but I'd love to hear what you all think, because for me, that's where we can really start to make a change.
This is Ann Clark at the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is The Importance of Diversity in the Environmental Movement for the 21st Century. And we'll return to our panel now and for their continuing stories and information. Adriana?
Thank you, Ann. So let's talk a little bit about that, about how we can bring people and elevate people more in this movement, and a little bit about where that breakdown began and how we can start to change that. Whitney?
It's a great question. And while you're talking, I was sort of like, huh, I wonder why that is. And it makes me think it's probably a couple of things. One is that sort of data and science is compelling, you know, if done well, but emotion is messy. But it is authentic and it is real and it touches the heart, but you got to deal with the messiness too. And so, you know, when I think about the work that I now do for Green 2.0 in dealing with the people, which is, you know, increasing the people of color in this movement, sometimes it gets really messy. Because I have to turn people's hearts
more than I need to do anything else. And so when I think about my days, some of my days is actually spent, you know, doing the work. But like I had a phone call earlier today that I just spent an hour talking with somebody through a really challenging situation. But that's the gig. And being ready to take on the role of armchair psychologist on a regular basis is part of the work. But it means in the end that I have this wealth of story and understanding and empathy, but also the ability to change other people with that story. But if I didn't take that hour, I wasn't expecting to. there's now someone else who I have that I now understand what the challenge is, but also the opportunity.
That's really, I love that, that emotion is messy, but it's authentic. And it's that authenticity, I think, that really resonates with all of us as humans. Pallavi, what do you think about this whole mess? Yes.
And that's also a difficult question for me, not only because of what you said, but also because I'm a scientist by training. So for most of my life, I have thought of data and numbers first before anything else. So it's a real challenge. It took a lot of education on my own part to understand why the human side is important. I'm totally bought into it now, but it did take me a while to get there. I think there are reasons, and I'd also just encourage us to think about a combination of data and stories. So I think stories are compelling, they're passionate, but without being able to say what solutions look like based on what numbers, it is difficult to move policy, right? Absolutely. So at the end of the day, if you want to hold your legislators accountable, if you want to hold your decision makers accountable, your local councilmen accountable, you have to have a sort of evidence, stories, and some results associated with it. So let's think about, you know, what does that beautiful partnership look like? The other challenge is that the scientific community has not done a very good job of interacting with communities. There's a long history, and we're paying for it now, right? There's a long history of how science and data gathering had a very abusive relationship with people that it was trying to study, you know, communities that it was trying to fix. And that's not an easy paradigm to turn its head over. So just figuring out in one of the projects and jobs that I was doing, we were trying to address the question of the gap between science and environmental justice and what has led to that gap. And really what it came down to is a whole recognition of the history behind that. Like, why is that a relationship which is fraught with distrust? And why is it that communities don't want to have any more of the numbers thrown at them? So I think it's a really important question, but also something that requires both sides to acknowledge the past, acknowledge that there was a problem with that relationship, and also then to think about how do we bring them together to deliver sort of the progress and gains that we really want to bring attention to and solve.
That's so, so important. I'm really glad that you spoke as a scientist as well and acknowledged the fact that there is that painful history that we all need to learn. First of all, own. I read somewhere that an apology has so much power simply because it says, I see you, I see the pain. And even if it's just a word, it heals because all of a sudden that person, that community, whoever it might be on the receiving end, says, "I'm now seen. I'm now felt. I exist." And so many times, science can make us feel like we don't exist, like we are just another number. So that's a very, very important point that you raise, and I really appreciate that. So Michelle, tell us a little bit about your perspective on this, because you mentioned it a little bit in your opening about why why working at Green for All especially is so important to you, because the fact that you've married these two issues and you do work directly with the community. But give me your perspective on why you think on how we kind of bridge that gap that exists right now.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you one thing that I'm seeing, right, and that worries me. With the new administration in office, I think we can't ignore that, right? We have a new administration now. We transitioned out of the Obama years where we had a champion for clean energy and moving us forward on climate goals. And we now have an administration that wants to pretend that it doesn't exist. And, you know, we don't need that. Let's build more dirty infrastructure. So we're in a totally different situation. And it causes people to do some interesting things. And I think one of those things is to run to the safe space, what feels safe, what feels comfortable. And so I'm beginning to hear things like, you know, the need to sort of reinvigorate some of the iconic fights around things like the Arctic and, you know, and those are great. And they speak to specific communities. And so it's not that we don't do those things. It's that what does that mean then for communities that, you know, we've started to make some progress in bringing into these conversations, addressing policy solutions and creating solutions that will bring them along and uplift all communities. And then, so what does that mean now, right? If we're only focusing on that, or we go back to a certain core that says, well, we're for environmental solutions that actually put diversity, that actually put communities that are living on the front lines of poverty and pollution second. If we can do that, right? First, we do this. And if we can throw it in there, we'll work on that too. But that puts them second. And so I think, you know, people who are living day in, day out in these most polluted communities with the health issues, you know, seeing the effects, it's not lost on them. Let's put it that way, right? People who are left behind, when we leave people behind, they know you've left them behind. We move on, you know, we're fighting certain things, we get certain wins, we feel good, our strategy seems right. But the communities that we leave behind know we'll leave them behind. And then that goes back to the history, right? So in 5 years, in 10 years, whenever we need them again, or whenever they see, you know, how hard is it going to be to try and rebuild that trust after it's broken and broken and broken? So I'd say, you know, I don't know if I'm even answering your question at this point, but it's so complex, right? Yeah. All of these things are going on. And so it's more than message, I guess, is the key thing I want folks to take away, is that it's more than messaging. It has to actually include strategies and solutions that do put these communities first. And I say first because if we aren't tackling pollution where it lives, which is predominantly in low-income communities and communities of color, then how are we addressing the climate crisis, right? How are we actually building a clean energy future for all if we're okay with environmental sacrifice zones and a dirty future for some? You know, it just doesn't make any sense. So that's actually the front lines of our fight. And if we can start there, then I think we build both, a stronger political base of support, for one, to do all the things that we need to do. At Green for All, we've been starting to talk about, you know, what is it that makes our messaging different, right? And like figure out, how do you capture that in a phrase? And it's, you know, a lot of people are messaging in a way that says, we need to save the planet. Global warming, climate change, destruction, right? We need to save the planet in order to save the people. And what's missing is we need to save the people in order to save the planet. And I think so it just takes that.
Flipping that. Yeah, no, yeah. That's a really, really great point to make, because it's so true. You raised precisely, we're right on target. I was just going to talk about the current administration, because we can't avoid the fact that we are undergoing a huge shift in our, really a complete paradigm shift, frankly, and living in this new world order that seems to be frightening for most. So for me, I see it as the time where we need all hands on deck. And unfortunately, we forgot that we've actually needed all hands on deck all along.
Yep.
So we just got complacent. We got lazy. We thought, okay, we can win it this way, we can win it that way. And guess what? We wake up today and we realize that we have a ton of burnt bridges, a lot of hurt feelings, a lot of people who we have no relationships with, even if we have no bad history with them. And now all of a sudden, we all need each other.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
And so in my work, my goal has been to find ways to build those relationships, both with the most impacted communities who are truly going to suffer the most, even many of those who may be gung-ho on what they're hearing, who are not realizing how seriously they are going to be impacted by some of these policies if they're carried out the way that they're envisioned, that we fear they may be carried out. But also because I think we have a really good opportunity. You know, times of crisis either break us apart or can bring us together. And I believe that this is an opportunity for us to come together, not only with environmental justice leaders, community leaders, but also with people who are working in other spaces, with the health community, with the faith community, as we talked about, and with people who are working on a variety of issues that are also under attack. Because if we look at what's happening under the current administration, it's truly a systematic disenfranchisement of all of those who are perceived to have had a free ride under previous administrations. The perception is completely false, first of all. But what it has done is it's invigorated a lot of people to try and claim their political voice. Sadly, it's also suppressed, because that's what it's designed to do, to suppress political engagement and political speech and people's voices. So I feel that it's our responsibility to help elevate those voices, whether they're voices of the poor, disenfranchised, people who are suffering due to their immigration status, due to their gender identity, due to their health status, due to their disabilities, whatever it might be. Until we're able to really bring all of those voices into the conversation, we're not going to win on anything. Because if right now in Congress we're seeing things like what we're seeing, you know, the systemic dismantling of regulations, for example, that's going to affect us all. Even if you never once thought about the environment, guess what? It's going to affect you in your food. It's going to affect you in what you pay for your cable or your phone. It's going to affect you in many ways, never mind voting rights and everything else. So I feel like this is a moment for us to bring environmentalism deeper into the democratic process and really talk about this as yet another issue that affects us all. That you don't have to know the first thing about climate science to know that you should be protecting your food, protecting your family, and speaking up for what's right. And so I actually want to invite a guest who's joining us today is Dr. Christina Hecht, and she works on drinking water issues. But working with the health community is something that's going to be extremely important because of the exposure that health practitioners have to others in the community. So I wonder if you wanted to say a few words now, Christina, about your work. And if we need to get the mic, we can start to jump in on the panel. Oh, no, great. Anne's got us covered. Say a little bit about your work and why you think this additional diversity of issues is so important. And then I want to turn it back to us about how we can better do our job in achieving that. Christina.
Thank you, Adriana, and it's a delight to be here tonight with all of you. I've never been to the Commonwealth Club before. I'm Christina Hecht. I work at the University of California Nutrition Policy Institute. It's an institute that's over the whole university system, not campus-based. And I just want to comment on a couple of words that you just used, Adriana, that I think are really important for us to think about. You were talking about regulation, but then a few minutes later you used the word protect. And I think that one thing that we can all start doing is talking about regulations as protections instead of regulations, because people understand protection, yep, and they like the idea of protection. So we don't need to buy into that regulation thing. We can talk about protection.
Thank you for calling me out on that. You know, that's the type of thing that we get caught up in. And this again, I love science. Nothing against science, but it's the science speak that, or political speak, or whatever it is that doesn't help us. But anyway, please continue.
Well, I work on issues of drinking water. And one reason why drinking water is so appropriate tonight is that it's really a place where all these issues we've talked about come together: environment, health, equity, social justice, urban and rural, so many of these different categories. And the nice thing about water is that people get water. They like water. They get the idea. It's simple, and it's something we know. We actually know how to solve our water problems. It's just a choice whether we do it or not. So that's what I'd like to say right now.
Well, that's wonderful. And just I know that Anne will need the mic a little bit, but if you can hold on to it and jump in as well, I want to go ahead and start with you all. How can we do a better job at bringing this idea of all hands on deck into reality? And I think Christina pointed out one way is changing the way we talk about our issues. What are other ideas that you all have, and things that have worked, things that may not have worked? Yeah. Feel free to jump on in.
I have an
So what I say is, like, it's been fascinating to watch the beginning of intersectionality in the environmental movement start to happen. And it's been in small pieces, but it's been really fascinating. When organizations, especially at the top, start, and they're short, you know, blog posts, press releases, but they're focused on different issues. The Orlando shooting, Black Lives Matter, reproductive rights, indigenous rights. You start to see, and especially in the last like year and a half, I've seen more leaders of major environmental groups at least have some statement about these issues. That's the beginning. But what I actually think back to is, and if you haven't listened to this, Wynton Marsalis, so I'm a jazz fan, if you don't know that too, has a wonderful album called Blood on the Tracks. And there's a piece in it where there's also this wonderful sort of spoken poetry about, you know, first they came for the blacks, then they came for the Jews, then they came for, and he walks through this, and then they came for me. And it's this wonderful recognition that if you don't fight for everyone else, you can't fight for yourself. And so it's the acknowledgement of, like, sometimes you need to step out of your lane entirely and be willing to fight for someone else's right, because in the end, that's the only way you can also defend your own.
Thank you, Whitney. That's so, so important to remember. And it's taken a longer time than it should, huh? Because if you think back to the history of the environmental movement, it did start back in the civil rights movement, and we somehow lost our way. How else can we find our way? Pallavi, Michelle, jump on in.
Did you want to say anything?
Oh, yeah. Go ahead, Pallavi.
Okay. I think it's a question we get challenged by every day, even more so since January, because I think conceptually we at Rainforest Action Network believe that we are here for all the causes that our individual staff care about, as we as an organization care about, the very broad human rights and justice issues. I think the challenge really becomes evident when you're talking about maintaining your supporter, quote unquote. You can define your supporter however you want, either your donors or your members or people who take actions on your websites. How do you bring them along the same way you come along in an organization? So how do you go from megafauna, which gets us lots of dollars, to actually talking about climate impacts on communities at a day-to-day level. And that connection, I don't want to trivialize it at all, because that's where the rubber hits the road, right? That's where we actually have to make a decision about, do we lose people who unsubscribe because they don't get the connections we are trying to make because we haven't brought people along into what those connections are. So you're right, we are coming to it really late in the game. And that's why it's difficult. You were talking, Michelle, about how you damage a relationship and it takes 10 times over to then repair it. So I think it's a work in progress is really what it is. We have to, I think Trump administration and actions give us sort of renewed vigor to take it on. But I worry that we have a certain amount of urgency associated with it, and I don't want to lose it when situation changes around us. So not to be able to completely answer it, but it I recognize the challenge, also recognize that we have to continue working on it.
So let me ask one question about that, and then I want you to answer, Michelle, as well, where we are and what we need to do. But I have an idea based on what you said, because it's the same thing that happens at NRDC. How do we keep our members, keep our donors, keep everybody, make everybody happy? And you're right. You said megafauna, which for those who don't know is big places, big whales, big, right. Bears, and a lot of these very iconic creatures who are beautiful and they move us all, no matter who we are. They are very good fundraisers for us. My guess why, because we've talked about this internally as well, why do people issues not resonate as much? And I think it goes to what Whitney said, because people and emotions are messy, and we don't want to get, we're okay with getting emotional about an animal, but we're not okay somehow getting emotional about a person. It's funny, I was just this weekend, we were at the aquarium, and there was a turtle on its back, and there was a crowd, everybody in that aquarium was watching this turtle struggle to flip over. And what I said to the kids who we were with was, you know, it's funny, all of those people are suffering over this turtle. People were crying over this turtle. Yet they are quick to walk over a person who is dying of hunger on the street. And how, why that is something that's probably for a whole other conversation. But it's that challenge as well. And I think that's one of the things that gets in the way of our communicating on environmental issues that really affect communities. But Michelle, I'd love your thoughts on this, because I know that Green for All, and unless you wanted to jump in real quick, Whitney, you were there. So,
and it's just a quick comment, but I'm always struck by the concept of ecosystems and the fact that we as humans often don't insert ourselves into the ecosystem when we frame it.
That's really
and funny. That's, for me, I think that's part of the challenge that we often run into in disconnecting humanity from like this thing that we want to protect and retain without realizing we're actually part of it. And I think that also contributes to then the disconnect around adding people in and thinking of us as also the center of this. Because for some reason, like when you think about ecosystem pictures, like just Google like ecosystem pictures, you will almost never see a human in them.
That's true.
And it's like this baffling thing for me around like, so why is that? Why have we pulled ourselves somehow out of nature in some respects? And then pulled ourselves then out of being integrated into that whole and thinking about us as part of that system. And then communicating that effectively to think about communities and other people. We're all part of that system. Mm-hmm. And you can't separate those things out, even if mentally and sort of psychologically you try to.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, yes, yes. I'm like taking it.
Tell
in.
Us, I love tell us, Michelle.
It's true, and it's true what you said early when we first started, Whitney, is that oftentimes we're the only person of color in rooms where we're talking about environmental issues. So this is refreshing for me. But I want to say, in addition to talking about how these issues affect low-income communities and communities of color in the negative way, I actually think we need to help do more storytelling to show low-income communities and communities of color in the clean energy future, uplifting stories of things that are working. So these aren't just communities that need saving. That's definitely not the case, right?
Not the message by far.
And definitely not the message. Yes, definitely not the message. So as we think about, you know, well, how do we do more to stand in solidarity with frontline communities, so on and so forth, we have to recognize that while this may be, you know, new for some organizations to come to the concept of working in partnership with environmental justice communities and so forth, for environmental justice communities, it's not new, right? They've been fighting the fight on the ground, and they've been innovating solutions, and there are solutions that work. That's right. And there's a lot of genius in communities, and so we've got a whole toolkit on this if you want to know what, like, cool stuff is going on in places across the country. It's on our website. But helping to tell more of that story, right? And California is such a great breeding ground for this. So our director, Vien Trong, helped win the largest fund in history for investing in reducing pollution and growing the green economy in disadvantaged communities, like specifically directing funds to uplift, you know, create jobs, green up low-income and polluted communities here. We take funds from polluters and we invest it in polluted communities. So it's doing things like allowing Alameda County to purchase a whole batch of fuel cell buses, you know, to help their whole public transportation system go green. It's doing things like creating electric van pools in Fresno, where there haven't been established bus lines, and helping people get to work and get to the hospital in less than 2 hours, you know, which is what it was taking before. It's doing things like reducing Maria Zavala's energy bill from $200 a month to $1.50 a month because she was able to get solar on her affordable home. And when we tell those stories of solutions that uplifted communities that needed it most, and you create tangible benefits with these policies that affect real people, then you start to see yourself in the future to fight for, right? Then I have a stake in the matter. There is something we can get here. We can actually improve our lives and address some of our core issues by fighting on these environmental solutions too.
That's great. I love that. The solutions are definitely where it is. Now, Christina, you had something that you wanted to add, but we need to make an announcement.
This is Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California, and I want you to know that I am one of those persons who came out of the Civil Rights, War, and Poverty movement, and that's the movement that really started me later on to come into the environmental movement. So everything that we are hearing tonight, I think, is really based in the struggles that have gone on for many years in many ways, and I really appreciate it. Our program tonight is the importance of diversity in the environmental movement for the 21st century. And we have as our moderator and our facilitator, Adriana Quintero, who's Natural Resources Defense Council and founder and director of Voices Verdes. And with us also is Whitney Tome, who's executive director, Green 2.0, and counsel for the Raven Group. Thank you. Palati Parativ, who is the Deputy Director of the Rainforest Network, and Michelle Romero, who's Deputy Director of Green for All. And now we are moving into our questions from the audience. And so if you have a question, I'm going to help you with those questions, and we are going to see if there's someone who has a question. And we've got two people, so let's start here and move back.
Good evening. Thank you so much. My name is Carla Mays. My company, I have a smart cities company here in San Francisco, Mays Civic Innovation. One of the things that I know you mentioned, we've been inventing and we've been doing the work, but the issue is getting the funding mm-hmm. from philanthropists, you know, from foundations, community foundations. We play the chicken and the egg game all the time. And, you know, we've been looking for jobs in the environmental movement and to take leadership positions. But it has been a very difficult in uphill battle. What has been done or what's being done, you know, for those of us who are on the front lines of the civic and social innovation?
So I'll take a stab at like a part of that. So Green 2.0 is really focused on actually trying to get more people of color in this movement. Full stop. And we're really trying to take the approach of saying, like, look, big green groups, big philanthropists, federal government agencies, you need to get on the bandwagon. And I do a mix of two things. One, holding actually people accountable to making that change through data and other things. And we're actually, in a couple of weeks, going to put out our first data analysis for the NGOs, the top 40 NGOs of where they are. But what I also like to do is give people resources. I just don't want to tell them like the bad news, but also do like the, here's what you do inside your organization to actually make the change. Here are the best practices across the board. Start implementing them. And so that's sort of my and our organizational mission, to try to push that, to make that change at that level, but also to help funders and other folks shine a light on the fact that, like, you don't know everyone who's doing amazing work in this space, but you need to start asking to see them and bring them in the room, so that if there's a big green group that partners with a smaller group that says, oh, hey, we're going to give this group money, it's like, well, are they in the room with you?
Right.
And if not, why not? Right. And ask them, as especially as a funder, I want that person, that leader of that organization, in the room. So when we talk about these issues, I get to hear it directly from them rather than filter through someone else. And so it's one of the many messages, but it's one of them that I'm trying to drive home.
Very important.
Yes. Here's a question for each one of the speakers. Given that we have the different administration now, the Trump administration instead of the Obama administration, what have you had any changes in direction or emphasis of your activities as a result?
Go ahead, Paul.
Sure, I can talk about the Rainforest Action Network and then Michelle. Yes, we've had to reconsider a lot of our campaign strategies because there are certain campaigns that we had, such as Keep It in the Ground, which was preventing drilling from public lands and offshore drilling. And we know that we have an administration that is never going to sign an executive order to protect that. So recognizing what the limitations of a certain campaign are was an important exercise for us. We are redirecting some of our domestic campaign into things such as movement building, such as intersectional work, such as how do we train and provide resources to communities who ask us for that. So recognizing that communities have their own expertise, they have their own demands, but making sure that we can provide the areas where they do actually need help. We are also doubling down on our corporate campaign work because we've pretty much elected a corporation into power. And that's a really solid hook for us to motivate people, to get them along, to bring them along, and drive action on challenging corporate power. So those are some things that we are shifting our focus to.
Yeah, I'm trying to think, what can I say? Well, our president and founder, Van Jones, predicted that Trump could win. And so in some ways, we've been having these conversations internally about what would Plan B look like for a while. And I think that, so there are changes that are being made. One thing that hasn't changed is that in terms of advancing actual real policy solutions, that fight is local. That fight is in the states. That fight is not, we're not going to see anything new positive coming out of the federal administration. And in many ways, the ending of the Obama era actually was leading there anyways. And change has always happened in the states, but the whole idea behind the Clean Power Plan and issuing that rule, which set caps on pollution from power plants, was that the next phase was state implementation. And so in some ways, our strategies were the same, right, or continuing. But the biggest thing that has shifted for us internally is how we communicate. So and doubling down on the communication strategy as the strategy for advancing policy. Because you can't just be lobbying and working on, we're in a huge air war. And Trump in some ways is, a master of misinformation, misdirection, and all of these things that we're fighting. And every organization is responding in different ways. And like I said, in some ways, very familiar ways that aren't working, I don't think are working. And so what we're doing is at the same time as building bridges across movements, right, with labor, with racial justice organizations, environmental groups, environmental justice groups, and so on, we're also trying to step away from the noise and just really focus in on what's the message that needs to land to fight Trump's message. He has a way of resonating with ordinary people and saying things that make common sense. If you don't know the facts, right? And most people don't know the facts. Like, we have to just, as much as we think we're so great and we're doing all this great work, like, still, most people just don't know the basic facts. And so we have to accept that and figure out then what is the smart strategy to counteract that. And so one example I want to give that's really specific, just this week, Rick Perry is quoted in the news as saying that the Trump administration is having these very, very exclusive conversations around, taking over or sort of undercutting states' abilities to set caps on pollution and require any sort of percentage of energy to come from renewables or to come from clean energy. Whether that actually happens or not is a totally different thing. I have opinions on that, obviously, but I think it's a test. I think it's a test. I think it's a test to see how the environmental community responds from a messaging standpoint. He wants to see how, frantic we go about, how do people respond? And the people investigating whether that's even a viable option, how loyal will they be? And so we step away from a lot of our strategy right now is stop listening to all these like 20 different, 100 different ideas of what needs to happen and just like really focus on what he's trying to do and think strategically and intentionally around how we combat that message. Because in that quote that article that I'm referring to, he talked about how renewables are unreliable because the sun only shines when it shines and the wind only blows when it blows. And so solar and wind just aren't reliable sources. And this is a matter of national security.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
Honestly, you're right.
But it's
like
true.
Most people know the sun only shines when the sun. So right. It's figuring out then what do you need to say that connects on an individual level right. in a mass appeal way that is not right. facts and science. And yeah.
Yeah, it's true that misinformation is a powerful and very dangerous tool. So it's important for us not to. At NRDC, we're doubling down on litigation, but also on communication as well and building a much broader movement. I think that that's just got to be the solution. And I know that the other groups that I talk to have a similar perspective, which is why I think that making sure that it's truly diverse is so important. I want to make sure that we keep the conversation going if there are other questions.
Yes. Unfortunately, we have come to that point in our program for our last question. And this is Ann Clark from the Commonwealth Club. And we have a member here who's going to ask that last question.
Thank you. I'd like to know how an individual can help with all the information that you have given us. What do we do with it?
That's a great question, and that's a perfect ending. So I wanted to just give a quick moment to Christine. If you have any thoughts on this, I want you to go ahead and jump in, since you do work so closely with so many individuals. I think that the best thing that you can do is speak up. Inform yourself as much as possible and make your voice heard. Don't be afraid to ask for what we need and what we deserve as contributing members of society. We have a right to a clean environment, to clean water, to clean food, no matter what our race, gender, socioeconomic status is. So I think that that's the way, that would be my most important suggestion to people.
This is Christina Hecht, and I'd like to bring the conversation back to an early point, which is talking about data and stories. And I think that one thing that we can all do is get a couple of facts really straight based on the data and then use that as the basis for our stories. There's a lot of misinformation out there, and the stories really matter, but they need to be fact-based too. So, yeah, I come from the science background also, but I would recommend choosing a few facts that matter to you and getting those really straight and then spreading them.
Okay. Now we're running out of time quickly, so how about we each go down the line? Actually, let's start with you, Michelle. Quickly, what can people do?
Well, we talked about Flint today. I'll just say one thing that we're doing is raising money to fix the pipes in Flint to bring clean water to that community and just show that we're not actually going to leave people behind, that that's not okay. And so if you go to greenforall.org, we're running a campaign where all of the money is going to Flint, and we're just donating our time and everything to facilitate that. So that's one really concrete thing you can do.
Thank you.
I'd say you can join us on the streets. We are doing a lot of bank actions because with the idea that we want to turn off the financial input into extractive industries. So we have, if you're looking at systemic change, change can come from stopping feeding into all the things that lead to the pollutants that we then have to fight for. And also, I'd say preserve your energy because this is going to be a long fight. So come to the streets again and again and again. Thanks.
Ask challenging questions. It's a very simple thing, but it's one that forces leaders and others and yourself to say, why am I doing this? Is this the right thing to do? Or am I missing something? Is there a group that's not being included? Is there a voice I'm not hearing? Is there something that's missing? And honestly, asking those challenging questions in the moment forces other people to answer them. And it forces them to come up with either a really great answer or a poor one, or to recognize that they're unable to answer your question. But then hopefully that helps to cause them to think about, okay, so why couldn't I answer? Or why didn't I give the elegant answer I wanted to? To then hopefully the next time have an answer and have an action that comes with that answer.
Those are great, great tips. Thank you all so much. And thank you all for being here and spending this evening with us. I'm Adriana Quintero from NRDC and Voces Verdes, and I invite you to visit nrdc.org as well for more information. Thank you especially to our host, Ann Clark, and to the Commonwealth Club of California for hosting us here today. Stay informed, stay active, and working together, I truly believe we can achieve great things.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is the importance of diversity in the environmental movement for the 21st century. And we've had a wonderful panel. We want to thank Adriana Quintero from the Natural Resources Defense Council and founder and director of Voices Verdes for being our moderator and our inspiration in putting this program together. She's really been wonderful. And to our panel, Whitney Tome, who's the executive director of Greenpoint 2 and counsel for the Rabin Group. Thank you, Whitney. And Michelle Romero, who's deputy director, Green for All. And finally, for Pallavi Parati, who is the deputy director of the Rainforest Network. It's really been a very interesting and in many ways, I think, inspiring, and always been inspiring from the audience questions we had tonight and our other guest who was with us tonight. So let's have a big thank you and applause for our program tonight and all of us, all of you who participated in it, for our terrific speakers. So a big applause for our speakers. And many thanks, many, many thanks to you and our audience here today. You've been a wonderful audience, and we certainly appreciate you being here and listening to the conversations that we've had. And they have been really wonderful conversations. And also thanks to our audience on the radio, on podcast, and internet. So a good round of applause for our wonderful audience, our radio audience, podcast, and internet. This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. I thank you, and the Commonwealth Club thanks you for being with us tonight. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned. Thank you very much.